Good morning, everyone, to the second day. It will be a very packed day today, so I hope that we can all keep our concentration and enthusiasm well until the evening. And enthusiasm is not to be confused with agitation, you know. Okay, with that, I pass over to Javid, to Craig. Okay, and we start with paper 18C.
Yeah, well, so thank you, Andreas. I was just going to explain that, of course, we have three papers in general for you this month, and these go into the detail of some of your preliminary views about disclosing quantitative information on synergies, about the contribution of the acquired business, and about financing and pension liabilities. And so I was just explaining from, you'll see from the agenda that we have around 40 minutes before the break, and then most of our time is after the break. And therefore, we've tried to decide that everyone start with agenda paper 18C, which we hope will fit neatly into the time before the break, and we'll discuss the rest afterwards, starting with A and B. And so I'll hand over to Zicheng, who's going to introduce 18C.
So, thanks, Craig. So to the first paper today, on goodwill and impairment. So we have this agenda paper 18C, liabilities arising from financing activities and defined benefit pension liabilities. So this paper provides the board with our analysis of feedback on the board's preliminary review to develop proposals to specify that liability arising from activity and financing activities and defined benefit pension liabilities are major classes of liabilities. As noted in paragraph 22, our recommendation is not to proceed with your preliminary review, but instead propose amending first paragraph B64(i) of IFRS 3 to remove the term major from the requirement to disclose major classes of assets acquired and liabilities assumed. And second, paragraph IA72 of the illustrative examples accompanying IFRS 3 to illustrate financing and pension liability as material classes of liabilities assumed. Our main question for the board is on page 8 of this paper, and that is whether you agree with our recommendation. So now I will leave the floor to the board. Thanks.
Jane, can I see whether board members have any comments? Mary, off you go.
Start up by saying, first of all, I agree with basically where you want to get to, which is instead of writing a specific requirement to step back and achieve the same thing. I have a, could you look at the wording question for the actual amendment and then also a communication suggestion. The can you look at the wording is, I looked again this morning at 24B as material classes of liabilities assumed. I'm thinking about the disaggregation requirements, which I'm not sure they focus on material as opposed, you know, so just look again at the words in IS1 and think also about the PFS proposals and just line up the wordings there. And then the second one is just an overall communication point. Rather than saying that we're not proceeding with the preliminary view, to just say we, you know, recommend that we take the following action to achieve the objective, because I don't want it to miss-signal that we are not trying to achieve the same thing. We're just doing it a different way.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair comment, because it could be perceived as forget about our proposal, but it's not really what we are suggesting, right? It's still maintaining it, but achieving it in a different way. Bertrand?
On this, I don't disagree with the staff recommendation, where they, like Mary said, where they want to lead us making a decision. My only point would be a wording suggestion. Instead of mentioning, because the illustrative example 72, or yeah, it's that, already talks about financial liability. Financing liability is not a term that is defined in our current literature. So, so as to make it perfectly clear, I would have used a terminology closer to what is in paragraph 44, capital A of IS7, which mentions changes in liabilities arising from financing activities. So even if the wording is longer, I think it would stick more to our current definitions in our literature. So something around liabilities arising from financing activities rather than financing liabilities, which are honestly for a non-native English speaker very hard to distinguish from a financial liability. So there's a nuance there. I perfectly understand what it means. Many perfectly understand what it means. I'm not exactly sure if 100% exactly know the distinction.
Thank you.
I also agree with where you're heading, so these are just tuning points. Building on what Mary was saying, I think if we look at the discussion that we've been having about disaggregation in the context of primary financial statements, if my memory serves me well, the idea that we were using for the notes, the disclosures, was materiality. And so we should lean on that. And my suggestion is that in addition to using the illustrative examples, which are helpful, but they're just illustrations, it might be useful in the same way that when we at the Interpretations Committee have been looking at supply chain financing, where we had a bit of chat in the agenda decision about why that information would be material for investors, to think about whether it would be helpful in this situation to have something maybe in the basis that would I often find it helpful when I'm thinking about materiality if somebody can hum a few bars about how investors use information. So I just wonder whether there's anything we can bring out there that would help improve the application of materiality in this context, just to sort of build on your ideas here. And my only other comment was, it was interesting that a few people had suggested that there be a requirement to separately disclose some things which are seemingly already required in IFRS 3. And so that makes me wonder whether we've got an application issue that we should think about flagging with the firms and regulators to look out for.
Rick?
Thank you. I agree with what other board member already mentioned, but I think we specify something that preparers tend to focus those items specified in required standards rather than looking at and applying the materiality principle. So I think it's really important to align with what we are discussing in the PFS project about defining the requirement of disaggregation of information to the footnote. And also, I think I understand that it's very difficult to change the attitude in behavior in the practice, but I think we can delete major from the text. At the same time, we enhance the illustrative example to include financing liabilities and pension liability to understand what type of the things might be material in the footnote of this disclosure. So I think that kind of the change could affect the thinking of the preparers and auditors when applying the amended standards. So I think I agree with what recommended by staff.
Thanks, Rika. Zach?
So I just wanted to reiterate Sue's last point, which is what struck me, is we received information that required information isn't being provided, and there should be follow-up on that in some way from us.
Okay. No further comments by board members. That means, are we ready to vote? Can I see who would support the staff recommendation in question one?
Providing the wording.
Yes, I mean, taking into account the changes proposed by Mary and by...
12.
Okay, thank you. That makes question two redundant. So the question is now, what do we do?
Oh, sorry, performance, the contributions.
Yeah, we can start with that and see how we get the contributions.
On 18B, yeah. All right, okay.
Okay, so thank you, Andrew. So coming to the paper on 18B, contribution of the acquired business, we will key up each section and ask the board each question in turn. So in response of the to the feedback received on pro forma information during and after PIR of IFRS 3, the board's preliminary view is that it should first replace the term profit or loss in paragraph B64Q of IFRS 3 with the term operating profit before deducting acquisition-related cost and integration cost. Operating profit or loss would be defined in the exposure draft general presentation and disclosures. Second, add to paragraph B64Q a requirement to disclose cash flows from operating activities. And third, after revision in A and B, return the requirement for the information to be disclosed for the combined entity as if the business combination had occurred at the start of the reporting period. The first topic we discuss is whether the board should return the requirement in paragraph B64Q2. Our analysis is in paragraph 12 to 18. Our question is whether the board agree with our recommendation to proceed with its preliminary review and to return the requirement in paragraph B64Q2 of IFRS 3. That is the requirement to disclose pro forma information. Thanks.
Nick. Thank you. So this was certainly discussed at CMAC 12 to 18 months ago, and against the background of thinking about dropping this requirement, and a very strong view came back from CMAC members, which I think reflects user views generally, that this helps to form the basis of forecasting to go forward to understand both what the contribution would have been during the period when the business wasn't part of the group, and then what it was for those remaining months. You can then work out a kind of annual figure, and that provides you with some kind of basis for forecasting. I think generally it's accepted that there may be issues around accounting policy normalization and so on. But clearly, it's a highly valued piece of information by users generally, I'd say.
Thanks, Nick. Tadeu?
Thank you, Andreas, and thank you to staff for bringing the papers. I agree with Nick. My experience is that there are many cases in the regulator requiring the company going for a business combination before the shareholders, especially for listed companies, make a decision to present pro forma information to make the decision. It is, a very strong proof that this information is important, and the markets really welcome this one. And that's why I really think that this is a quite important it's a tiny piece of the standard, but you can't believe how important this is, at least in my experience as an auditor. I can see that how important this information is for making a decision to go ahead with a business combination. And one point that I just want to draw attention, one comment here that says, actually 2 points. Probably in the next one. There was one point that said that the information for the insurance companies would be on paragraph 10. I think that it doesn't make sense for a segment saying that this is a difficult information to be provided to a specific segment. I mean that every single segment might have some difficulties, but they have to do that. I really don't understand why the insurance industry believe that this is not feasible, for example, for them. And another point that I really want to draw attention is the fact that, sorry again for not, I think that there is a comment here saying that in Japan, and I think that Rika may help me with that, auditors say that the information is a non-audit information. I remember having this kind of discussion, and I think that if we start going in this direction, I'm just looking at the PFS project, where we have non-GAAP. Then you can imagine, for example, the auditors writing as well that this is a non-audit information. I mean that we are providing the basis for the information to be included. And it's supposed that I have enough information to be audited. That's the basis for the audit. It's a very subtle point in this paper, and I'm really glad that the staff brought this comment. I would investigate why this information is marked as non-audited in some, and which jurisdictions. Here it refers to Japan, but I would investigate whether other countries also have this position in relation to this specific information. I myself, I can't see any problem, but of course I have to understand what, for example, the IAASB or someone else has a say in relation to this one. Thank you.
Thanks, Tadeo. Can we hear from Rika then, who may be able to provide a bit of color?
Provide some practices in Japan. So it's not a matter of the accounting standards or audit standards. It's about the Japanese regulatory market rules. It specifically allows the entity to leave the pro forma information unaudited when the entity files a periodic document. So it's not about audit standards or accounting standards. Please understand that.
Thank you. Before I give the floor to Bruce, I would just like to provide a bit of color. Whilst I'm not disputing the usefulness of that information, the feedback that I had gotten in my previous role in the German environment was far more nuanced, in the sense that there was little uptake for pro forma measures. And my reasoning was really that the entities that participated in outreach events are really repetitive acquirers. So they restate on an ongoing basis. So if you then provide pro forma basis, if you just have one business acquisition, say, over a decade, I can clearly understand the argument because it gives you a hook and a starting base to actually develop a time series. But if you do have major business acquisitions going on year after year after year, the question is, what is the additional value that recasting the information and derive a pro forma as a basis is? Because there's so much going on year after year, which may, in addition to that, be overlaid by other effects, like foreign currency changes, inflation, and God knows what. So what we have heard from entities is that their users are really requesting a full set of pro forma financial statements, but rather are requesting specific targeted information, such as revenue numbers, for instance. So they're pointing at particular line items in the financial statements for which that would be useful, rather than saying go for full recast of information of the entire financial statements. And I wonder, whilst I don't object to there being this requirement, I think it is useful for the reasons that Nick and Tadeo have mentioned. The question to me is whether it would make sense to keep in mind that is it really every business combination that's taking place where we would request having pro forma information, or is it really the significant ones that are being reported up to the CODM? For which I can see clearly that being of use. But I mean, as I said, if you do think of a big company that does business combinations on a repetitive and ongoing basis, does it really make sense to recast every acquired entity and provide pro forma information? Question mark. So I would just like to bring this into the discussion. And I see that some people have raised their takes, which is good. Bruce.
Thanks very much. I think, as we all know, I'm never pro putting cost in terms of what preparers are doing, but I will agree with the staff recommendation on this one. I mean, I think there's definite utility in these numbers. I know that they are being used. I do agree with what Andreas said. I mean, I think the comment I'd written down here was we need to look at what is useful. And I do know that I've also had a similar comment where some people have said producing an entire set of proformas doesn't always give all the value that people need. So maybe we can just look at, you know, what are people asking for? What do users really need to dig down? And I will actually, I like the idea of thinking about whether it's only material or those reported to a CODM or just some sort of filter could be useful, because I think there is a lot of information that may just be going into those smaller business combinations where potentially there isn't the value, but I think we'd need to investigate whether that's there. I think the only other thing I'd say about, I think preparers are going to object to doing this, and the reason most of them object to doing it is because it's a bunch of work. And it's not really a lot of value for them at the moment when they're doing it. But I think the fact that I think this is one of those areas where I do think the benefit to the users is important. So I'd continue to do it. I think the argument that they're saying they don't always have the information doesn't really fly with me. I mean, generally, if we're talking about a major business combination, these things don't happen overnight. These things have got months, if not years, of planning. Information's been available. And it's one of those things that if you're going into a business combination, you kind of know you have to do. So you start preparing to get that information done. You wouldn't wake up the night before you do your group reporting and suddenly decide, hey, let's quickly do the pro formas. Generally, you're aware of this piece of disclosure, so you should be working on it in time. So I'm not, I don't really buy the argument that that suddenly you wake up on the 29th of December, decide to do a massive business combination and have to do this. The other thing I was going to say is when it gets to the argument of the cost, I wasn't too bought in with. The argument on the audit, I don't really know. I mean, I think this to me is, once again, it's one of the costs of doing a business combination. You've just got to build that into what you're doing on that. Just getting to the guidance, I'm not convinced that I would support putting in a lot of guidance on how you do this. And the reason for that is I think there's a lot of permutations around what we've got. So you've got everything from a company who can do a full pro forma with everything they need through to those who are starting to have to say, I can't get anything. And then you've got a myriad of companies in between who are going to start using this impracticable exemption to say, well, actually, I can get this information, not that information, some of this information. And then we'd have to start giving guidance of, well, what if you can't get this? How does it tie in with this? Do you have to give this? And I just worry that we could literally end up writing a book, another book's worth of guidance on the different permutations that happen within that. I actually like the way that B2 is written. I think we're saying you need to do this. People kind of understand what they need to do is the gold standard around that. And I think that impracticability kind of, to me, ties in and says you don't necessarily, if you can't get the information, we're not going to say, well, tough, you have to do it. We're saying we do accept that there may just be situations you can't do that. And to me, impracticable always is a pretty high hurdle. So, you know, it's, I was always explained to me, impractical doesn't mean that it's going to cost me money. Impractical means I've spent money and I just cannot get this information. So I think having that high hurdle in there, I think, keeps the value of the information that's been given in. So I would support what the staff are putting in there with those comments. Thank you.
Thanks, Bruce.
Can I just clarify what the information is we're talking about? Are we talking about a full set of financials? I thought we were just talking about revenue and profit or loss.
Yeah, the current requirement is just revenue and profit or loss, and the discussion is about whether to change profit or loss to operate.
Presentation one only.
Okay, so it's not the full set.
No, never has been. I meant the full set that we're talking about.
Yeah, but I think the
I just want to make sure we're not speaking across borders.
No, but so that's a helpful reminder. But I just think that some of the criticisms that we have heard on our preliminary reviews, I wasn't sure whether they really were just targeting revenue and profit or loss, or whether they were really thinking of full-scale performance. And this is why I think the clarification might be.
Because, I mean, when I was talking about the full set, I guess the revenue is the one that isn't as much. But I know that when you get to that profit and loss figure, I mean, that for all intents and purposes, you're doing the maths on doing this whole thing, and that's what I'm
concerned. I just wanted to make sure we weren't talking about the entire thing.
No, I was talking about the maths.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Can we hear from Rika, because she has to step out shortly?
I think if we don't have a good alternative with proforma information, I think a removal of the existing requirement shouldn't allow for us to meet the objective of this project, because we want to achieve the improvement in the disclosure requirement rather than reducing the quality of the information. So, and I also think we considered all disclosure requirement as one package. That means I think it's worth thinking the level of disaggregation of the other information, because I think if we use a materiality level for one disclosure and then we use other level of disaggregation for the rest of the disclosure, that would create inconsistency between the level of materiality and level of disaggregation. So I think it was considering the level of disaggregation is sufficient about this disclosure as well as other disclosure later. Maybe at this moment is not the right moment where we discuss about that point, but after discussing all the disclosure package, and then I hope we can bring that back to the board.
Thank you. Mary?
Support the staff recommendation, but wanted to ask a question and put in a couple of points about why supporting the staff recommendation. The basic reason for why, I think, was set up by Nick in his first comment about how important users find this information. But something else, and this kind of relates to my question, IFRS 3 is a largely converged with U.S. GAAP, and I believe, based on some helpful off-screen tutoring from Craig, that this the requirement for pro forma information also is present, although not exactly in the same form in U.S. GAAP. I think you pointed out that U.S. GAAP requires not just pro forma for the year of acquisition, but also pro forma for comparative periods. So I just wanted to flag that when we are looking at maintaining or changing requirements in a converged standard, I'd like us to consciously consider whether what we're considering would maintain or diverge. It's not that we can't, but just I want us to do that consciously, if we're going to and have weighed up the costs and benefits. And so a secondary reason, I think the primary reason is the usefulness of the information, but a secondary reason is this would maintain the existing level of convergence with U.S. GAAP to continue to have a requirement for pro forma information. The other thing that I wanted to pick up on was the something that Rico was just focused on, which is I'd be concerned about trying to slice and dice different levels of trigger, for disclosure within the standard. There was a, to me, very powerful paper brought to ASAF a number of years ago that I think the Koreans and Australians worked on it together about how we have different language for different thresholds, and they were looking at in the context of probability. But it also was brought home to us that material versus significant versus major, we don't have discipline around the use of those words. So when I look at the pro forma information, my instinct is to rely on existing thresholds for deciding whether the information is material and would have to be provided. Or, if you were a serial acquirer, whether your pro forma information for the year might omit information about relatively small items. And I agree with Bruce that we should not start writing a lot of application guidance about how you do it or how you assess the materiality. But I think Rika's point, what I inferred was, let's think about applying the same kind of trigger for disclosures about these combinations rather than varying as you go from aspect to aspect, because operational nightmare, unless we find something that is particularly costly and of dubious value, then we could create an exception. So support the staff recommendation as it is, and flag a couple things to note about why.
I also agree with the staff recommendation. Maybe I will echo one of my comments yesterday when we discussed the agenda consultation feedback. I think it's such an information is also useful for a preparer. I'm glad that it's also then useful for a user, but it's typically an example whereby this information for various reasons is useful for a preparer and is generally prepared by many preparers, maybe not all, but then there is an impracticability possibility in this paragraph. So I'm in agreement with the staff recommendation as it is.
Nick, you want to come back?
Yes, thanks. So just a few reflections. I think for most users, this isn't so much as building a long-term history. It's about being to get to the 12-month contribution from the acquired business. That's what the numbers allow you to do. As we've clarified, it's not a full recast, but the current wording in the standard is somewhat ambiguous. It talks about revenue and profit, but profit is undefined in the standard, and in practice you see it cast at various levels. Sometimes it does take it right through to net profit, quite often not always very helpful from that respect for users, because you're then trying to untangle tax and funding impacts. So I think in terms of where we're going, what's proposed to put it around operating profit, both brings clarity and greater utility also. In practice, I do find or do see that materiality is applied here. You don't get it on every single acquisition, so I think judgments used in terms of the information that's applied, and users would love 2 years. Mary, thank you for reminding me.
I wasn't suggesting that. I was just observing.
So am I.
Okay. So do I take it that we can take a vote on question one first? All right. Can I see who agrees with the staff recommendation?
11, one absent.
Okay, excellent. And some of you have already commented on question 2, 3, and 4, but do you want to introduce the relevant aspects before we start voting? Thank you.
Okay. So the second and the third question is about the guidance on how an entity should prepare pro forma information. So the second question, paragraph 25 to 30 contains our analysis. So our recommendation is to clarify the objective of pro forma information and not provide detailed application guidance on preparing pro forma information. And our third question is about whether to disclose the basis of preparation of the pro forma information. And the fourth is relating to ask the board whether we should replace the term profit or loss in paragraph 64Q of IFRS 3 with operating profit or loss. If the board defined operating profit or loss in our primary financial statement project. And our last question is question 5, under paragraph 59, and ask the board whether you agreed with our recommendation to not proceed with its preliminary review to add a requirement to disclose pro forma information about cash flow arising from operating activities.
Thank you. I agree with your recommendations. I just had an observation on the question about whether we need more clarity about sort of how you go about doing the pro forma information, and I agree with where you've landed. I think the objective is a good suggestion. My only thought is that I'm not sure that if you'd given me a test and asked me whether the way that I prepared pro forma information was an accounting policy matter, that I would have necessarily got my answer right. So it might just be worth making the observation that we think that it is included in the basis, because you know, the idea of what's an accounting policy or not is not, I think, terribly well understood, perhaps even by me. So I think it would be helpful to remind people if that's the expectation.
Yeah, Mary?
Yes, eerily but not surprising, I had completely the identical comment as Sue about question 2, just about picking up the information that's in paragraph 33 of this paper in the basis for conclusion, explaining why we felt it was unnecessary to write a specific example. And then, as I understand it, we're looking at all of the rest of the questions in the paper, not just question 2. I also support the idea of aligning with PFS. I think Nick explained that it would improve the consistency. The issue about integration and acquisition costs, again, that's something that I think right now we're not aligned with US GAAP on this aspect of the requirement for pro formas.
So I think US GAAP also doesn't require you to amend the pro formas, but it does require separate disclosures of the nature and amount of any material non-recurring adjustments that are in there.
Mm-hmm. And I think you were also pointing to requirements for that would apply if those costs were material to pull them out. So therefore, rather than writing it as a requirement for thou shalt do the pro forma this way, we just want to flag that those costs, if material, would be required to be disclosed, and therefore the information would be available for users of financial statements to model as they thought necessary and appropriate.
Yes, yeah, so the acquisition costs are already required to be disclosed separately, and if the PFS project goes ahead, you might get unusual items, depending on the board's...
Unusual items, and then in the rest of the comp package, yeah. we're also... I think something like integration cost would be more likely to be discussed in the context of... is a possible item for the kind of disclosures about post-acquisition performance type of thing. Would be a consideration. So, again, for the other questions, I support the staff recommendation, but I also suggest making sure that we pick up in the basis for conclusions why we might have thought it was unnecessary to specify how you deal with acquisition and integration costs, citing the existing disclosure requirements that we feel would pick up and ensure that material information about those items is provided to users of financial statements.
I have a question for the staff on this. Have you considered local regulations requiring already pro forma, the presentation of pro forma information? Have you flagged all jurisdictions that already require the presentation of pro forma information?
We know there definitely are some. We haven't looked at...
So the jurisdiction I come from, there is a regulation already in place that was published by the AMF, so the local enforcer. It's a very detailed recommendation that companies need to follow. There are thresholds, it's very detailed. So, and my observations will be based on that, because I'm pretty sure that there are other jurisdictions that would require that. So we need to be probably cautious so that our prescriptions would not conflict. I'm not saying that we don't need to do anything. But I wanted to make first this caveat, because we absolutely need that what we will prescribe does not conflict with the already existing requirements in various jurisdictions. And having said that, I don't disagree with the board. Then I would avoid pro forma information. As a starting point, I would avoid the labeling pro forma information so as to make clear that it does not conflict with recommendations already existing in various places and generally under the supervision of the enforcer. But having said that, I agree with the recommendation on question 2 or A, I don't know exactly how to label it. So clarify the objective of pro forma information and not provide detailed application guidance on preparing pro forma information. But then if we are not providing detailed application guidance on preparing pro forma information, I can't understand why we're not requiring and we're not having an explicit requirement for an entity to disclose the basis, even though it's covered already by the IS-1 general prescriptions. I perfectly understand that. I think for these reasons, if we were to maintain our recommendation, then we would need to ask for a specific disclosure. By the way, it is, and it refers back to my initial caveat, it is exactly what is stated in the recommendation in France, and this would typically conflict with the local requirements in France for this recommendation on the presentation of pro forma information in the financial statements. So I don't disagree with question 2. I don't understand why we would not add, and we would be shy in adding anything relating to explaining that companies explain what they have done. I mean, I don't see, even though it's covered by general prescriptions, I mean, it merits a specific requirements there. But then my only bit of concern is the conflict, the potential conflict with already existing requirements.
Just to be clear on that, if I understood you correctly, to me, that wouldn't constitute a conflict. So if we are silent, but there is a regulator that has additional requirements, I mean, there's nothing in our literature that would disallow an entity to actually make these things. We are just not requiring it.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I totally appreciate that. What I'm saying is what we will mention in the standards, we absolutely need to be careful that it does not conflict with already existing legal requirements, which are legal requirements. Because otherwise, then we will have two sets of recommendations for the same company. It will be impossible.
No, I get that, but I think your last point was really saying if we are doing away with our disclosure requirement, yet the regulator has one. I don't think there is a conflict, right?
I missed that, Andreas. So I will clarify my point. Independently of the local regulation in France, I'm still convinced that you need to, there's a pro forma information presented, a preparer needs to explain what he has done. I mean, otherwise, I think you're losing you're losing some of the value inherent to the information provided. And then I appreciate totally that there is already general requirements in IS1, but I think this specific requirement or the recommendation by the staff, let's qualify it at this stage, would merit a reminder that the basis of preparation needs to be disclosed. Independently of whatever. So my point was also disconnected from the local regulation.
Can I just ask a clarifying question? So is your concern more around the use of the word pro forma and to ensure we don't use that word when we're drafting, because that might conflict? And just to clarify, that word is not currently used in the requirement, and we would not intend to use it when drafting as well. We just use it as a short form in the paper.
Yes, but
as a short form for the existing requirement, but we can definitely stay away from using that same term when we do the actual drafting.
You're totally right, and I mean, it was my understanding, but I see the question as being presented pro forma information, even if I perfectly appreciate the shortcut in presenting the question. I mean, I just wanted to flag that, but it's more than just the words. It's also the content of what we will request eventually.
Tadeo.
Thank you, Andreas. I agree with the recommendation on question two. I think that it is an old wish to have a guidance on how to prepare pro forma. Usually what local preparers used to do is to look for where you have guidance. Some countries, they have the guidance. Sometimes they go for example, the SEC guidance. I mean, that we know that that's the way the market works, but I think that this is a completely out of the scope of what we are discussing here. This would be another project, probably a new standard. I mean, that definitely we shouldn't address this here. That's why I agree. In relation to accounting policy, I think that Sue raised a very good point. Sometimes it is, in my view at least, it is an accounting policy. I mean, that, and if it is material, it should be disclosed. But I think that this is covered by, should not be covered in this standard. This is covered by IS8, IS1, altogether. And that's why I agree that we shouldn't refer specifically to that one. But we can work the base for conclusion, just to draw attention to this one. And just one point that's quite important is that changing the profit or loss for operating profit. I fully agree with that because of the reasons described in the paper and reinforced by the Nick's comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Nick?
So
generally, I agree with going with this. I guess the piece where I'm feeling a little bit reticent is about just focusing on operating profit rather than the adjustments that were previously proposed. And it's not clear to me at the moment that we will particularly get the integration piece. Perhaps it will come elsewhere in the proposals. And why it's important is that I'm not so much interested in forecasting the year's P&L going forward. I'm actually trying to think about the basis of what the company could deliver over the medium to long term. And so I'm trying to get to a clean base number to understand what that, how that could play out. Really, I think that's what many buy-side users are trying to do. Sell-side users will clearly be more focused on the short-term forecast. And so it's not necessarily helpful making that change. I guess we may get it elsewhere within the total package of information that we're talking about. If we don't, we may end up relying on MPMs or other management-provided information to get those kind of data points.
Synonymous, yeah.
So I'm going to answer 2, 3, and 4. I hope that's the right universe. I've gotten a little lost. So I agree with recommendation 2. On recommendation 3, I think I share, or question 3, I think I share Bertrand's because we've said we're reducing diversity, but we're still allowing for significant diversity and judgment for good reasons. I think different national requirements. And so providing some guideposts to users when they're looking at a diverse universe is actually really useful information. Perhaps dealing with it in the basic conclusions will be strong enough. But I really want to make sure that point is in there, because I can already think of a number of situations. I know when we got the feedback to the exposure draft, I was somewhat surprised at some of the adjustments that were going in and couldn't believe they were taking place, because they kind of went against the disclosure objective I'd always thought about. And then on question 4, I think I'm generally in line with where Nick is, with maybe one slight difference in that with the shift to operating profit, I think the current construct as you've described it, where acquisition-related costs should be flagged, is wonderful. I share Nick's view that they probably aren't and won't be. I've certainly never seen them. And so I think, you know, talking about that perhaps in the basis of conclusions and in the disclosure objective is important. I think where I differ is we had proposed costs before acquisition-related expenses. I would prefer to see those acquisition-related expenses, perhaps of which, rather than excluding, would be a good construct for thinking of that. And then the other thing that comes to mind, and this is going to bear on later discussions, is if we move from operating profits, there is a universe of synergies and acquisitions that are below the line of operating profit. And so I think the staff recommendation later is to talk about total revenue synergies and total cost synergies as being the major line items. So we will have synergies occurring both above and below the line that aren't disaggregated under that construction. So something to think about and maybe keep in mind for the application of the pro forma information.
I just wanted to come in on this point about whether or not we need to explicitly require people to provide information about the approach they've taken to the pro forma information. And I totally agree that when that's material, that's information that should be provided, because it will be important from what I understand. But I think it's really, it's almost like a strategic decision, because every time we decide that we need to say out loud something which should already happen when you apply materiality to our existing requirements, I fear we're undermining those principles-based requirements, because we're building this sense that, you know, if we think we need to add it, then we're sort of saying, well, we didn't necessarily think you'd get that right answer. And I think that's risk encouraging people to think that if we haven't said it out loud, we don't really mean it. And so I feel like it's really important, and I think we should emphasise it in the basis to get the outcome that we expect. But even though I do agree it's really important, I'm really reticent with the behaviours we're creating for ourselves and our stakeholders. Just on the acquisition-related transaction and integration costs, when I was reading this, I was wondering whether the work that we're doing in PFS, again, might help us here in the sense that the idea that you should have disaggregation where there's material information to be obtained as a result of disaggregation, again, if applied well, I would think should help in this space. Maybe that's something worth emphasising as well, depending on how timelines work with the two projects.
Mary?
I'm coming back on this point about the disclosure of the basis of preparation, and I'm very much in agreement with Sue's strategic concerns about undercutting generally, you know, applicable requirements, which in some way should be the first thing people think of. And, you know, as well as the last thing they do, is there anything more that I have to disclose? But it does strike me as we're thinking about this information that maybe there's a comment we should be making in the authoritative piece of the standard that says the basis of preparation of this not labeled pro forma information should be treated as accounting policy information. So it's... Because I think somebody could look at this point and say it's not the actual financial, you know, information of the reporting entity, because it's saying as if the transaction had occurred at the beginning of the period, which is normally not when it actually occurred. So it's just making the point, you know, saying specifically treat the basis of preparation as accounting policy information, and then we can point out that then trips the general requirement for material accounting policy information. So think about, it's not a condition of my vote, think about that clarification.
Thank you. Ginger.
Thank you, and just general, I also support staff's proposal on question 2, 3, and 4. In relation to the question 2 and 3, that's whether we needed to add an explicit requirement for an entity to disclose the basis used for prepare those performer information. I also share same views as Sue said, that because from my perspective, our proposal is just not add explicit requirement for the entity to disclose those information. Does not mean that we are not require those companies to not disclose those information, because there is a general requirement in IS-1 there. So that means the basis is still very important information for them. But in order to bridge, so I exactly have the same proposal as Mary said, that because currently IS-1 only mentioned accounting policy, material accounting policy disclosure requirement. So how to bridge, you know, this proposal and also the general requirements of IS-1. So maybe if possible in the future, if the basis of a conclusion or some area can mention it and can build the bridge on this specific, you know, proposal and the general requirements of IS-1, maybe it will be helpful to apply that general requirements in IS-1 to this specific issue.
Just wondering whether really the basis for conclusion is the best placeholder for that, to pick up the comment that Mary had, right? And I'm making that comment because I wonder whether we err on the wrong side that people are frequently reading the basis for conclusion when applying our standards, and whether it may just not be more direct in terms of making it easier for preparers, auditors, users to find the requirement directly in the standard, but not by means of repetition, but rather by saying other pieces of required literature can be found or have to be adhered to in IS-1, IS-7, whatever it is. So that we point people directly to the respective sections rather than ducking that in the basis for conclusion. It's just a general consideration. And it was triggered really by a comment that we had yesterday when in a similar note, where we said we think that
something is already required by our literature, but we wonder why it's not picked up in practice. And I think it may just be that it is too unrelated, because people are focused on, say, for this standard business combination accounting, and they just see the required disclosures on business combinations, but fail to actually say, okay, is there anything in the general guidance that could become relevant as a cross-cutting issue and following from business combinations accounting? It's just the thought that I had. So I'm not disagreeing at all with what Jinzhao and Mary had said, but I wonder whether there is an argument, actually, that you elevate this into the main part of the standard. Just a reflection. Sorry, Anne.
This comes up in the Interpretations Committee, the work of the Interpretations Committee, and if it's in the basis, it isn't the part of the mandatory standard. So here, if we want this clarity and we want to say that this is an accounting policy disclosure when you describe how you've done your preparation for performer information, I think we have to say that in the standard. We can't use the basis to say this is a requirement, because the Interpretation Committee struggles with that all the time. When someone's trying to say, oh, it's a requirement, it's in the basis. No, if it's a requirement when it's in the standard. So I would agree with the comments that you've made, Andreas, that we have to be, if we want this, we have to be clear on it.
I think just to add on to that, to make it clear, I don't think that we have a requirement tucked away in the basis, but we use the basis as a reminder of already existing general requirements. That's how I read it. But I think that link to me is a bit too indirect, and it may be easier for those applying our standards if they have that explicit reminder being set in the main body of the standard rather than being hidden in the basis. That was my comment, really. So you want to comment on that?
A couple of things. Firstly, I don't disagree, because I think that is essentially what we're saying. You know, remember to read IAS 1 and IAS 8 before you pick up every standard, in a way. I think the tricky thing is, in the same way that we usually avoid reminding people of materiality in an individual standard, because then we feel like it has to be everywhere, I think if we were to put a paragraph in IFRS 3 to say, remember to read IAS 1, we basically should do that in all of our standards.
Yeah.
And that might be what you mean.
Exactly.
Because I think otherwise the people will say, okay, and that's different somewhere else. So maybe it's worth thinking about. But I think we do, we need to find a way to achieve this outcome, because, you know, sometimes at the staff level we've thought about whether we need some sort of a guide of how to apply IFRS standards, which almost starts off saying, you know, understand the conceptual framework, understand IAS 1, understand IAS 8, now pick up your particular standard. Because that sort of is what we expect people to do, but it's not natural for people to do that, and maybe this is a different way of achieving that. The other thing I wanted to just flag is, on this whole accounting policy versus whatever, I think one of the tricky things is that when we had the discussion in that project, I think rightly in the end we focused on changes in accounting estimates, if I remember correctly, and didn't tinker with accounting policies. And that's because we know that people, well, it's a bit mushy what's an accounting policy, and it's accounting policies, practices, and something or other, procedures or something like that. There's a whole string of words. And some of the examples that we had when we were working on that project, just to digress for a second, was, you know, even things like, I don't know, people deciding when they're building power lines, if they've got this length of cable, that's an asset, or if it's this length of cable, it's expensed. And there's all sorts of policies and practices and things that aren't, you know, is it fair value, is it cost type decisions that we intend to be captured in this accounting policy bucket. But I think, as the general matter, that's another communication challenge we've got over and above this whole idea of how to apply materiality and things as well. Because I think this is it's accounting policy and that broad notion of an accounting policy, but it's not a natural reaction necessarily for people.
Okay.
Bruce? Yeah, just to weigh on this quickly, I mean, I'm probably closer to where Sue is than where other people are on this. I mean, I was going to bring up the materiality point as well. I mean, I think we've been quite diligent in my time on the board of being careful when everybody says, oh, it's material, saying we can't keep repeating that. And I guess my worry about this one is I'm trying to work out what the requirement's going to say. So if we're going to put something in the stand, we're going to say specifically you need to disclose an accounting policy on this. Well, why here? Why not somebody else? As somewhere else? And I guess that just becomes my concern is on the consistency. I'd love us to get to a stage where we could, and all the stands would cross-reference and do all that. But I think if we decide that that's something we need to do, I think it's a separate project in terms of how accessible are the standards and do we think there's an accessibility issue that we need to address. I just worry that by making a specific one here. I think IS1 covers it. I think that my experience has always been that people have kind of used the basis of saying we're preparing our pro formas using the same accounting policies as the company. If those are different, we know we need to disclose that. And I haven't come across situations where people have, in my experience, where people have gone, we're preparing our pro forma information on a completely different basis and we're not going to tell people what we're doing. I just haven't come across. I mean, maybe other people have seen that, but I just don't necessarily think a specific requirement is necessary.
Neely, and then Tadeo, and then I think
we'll
draw to close.
Thank you. I understand the point about IS1 and the notion of materiality is all pervasive through everything in our standards. I think there's a nuance, though, that might be causing some confusion in practice, in that when you think about accounting policies, it's sort of, some may view it as it's tied to the double entry bookkeeping system, and it's tied to what's actually on the primary financial statements. Whereas if you think about what's a little bit outside the double entry bookkeeping system, so things like management performance measures, things like segment reporting, and things like pro formas, people may not view policy disclosure requirements as applying to things outside the double entry bookkeeping system. And as an example, so if you look at IFRS 8, there is a disclosure requirement to provide an explanation of the measurements of segment profit or loss. And if you think back about our management performance measures proposals, we also require a disclosure of the basis of preparation. So I see it both ways, but just to maybe try to tease out that nuance, that this is a little bit of a different flavor, maybe akin to segments, maybe akin to MPMs, that might merit having that sort of disclosure. And I think, Bruce, to your point about, shouldn't it just be the same as what the company is providing in its consolidated financial statements? I think the added bit here is that in addition to the policies and the consolidated financial statements, what is the company doing in its pro formas with respect to acquisition accounting, with respect to if it's a carve-out of another larger entity, you know, what's it doing with all of the carve-out adjustments that wouldn't necessarily be apparent unless you pulled that into a policy for disclosure? So just a nuance to think about.
I do vote on that. Today.
Thank you. Thank you, Andreas. I think that all the time that we discuss something, we will be on the temptation to try to include something to make us clearer. I mean, but we have to weigh this, whether it is really necessary, if it is already covered somewhere else. I think that I agree that the base for conclusion is not part of the standard, but actually it feeds the annotated version, all the guidance that are issued locally, and definitely it helps not to make our standard even more complex, because something that I always read in the papers is that adding this will add complexity. I mean, that every time that we add wording to our standards that is unnecessary, because it is, in my view, covered by IS1 and IS8. Actually, we are just making our standards worse. I agree that if we start thinking that maybe we should start doing some cross-referencing, etc., I think that the annotated version does it. And it's a very good piece of material. It's a kind of, sometimes we have this discussion about educational material. I think that the annotated version is a very good example of what we are doing in terms of consistent application and etc. I really don't think that we should make this point in the standard. I think that we should make this in the base for conclusion. Thank you.
Mary.
Sorry to push my luck on this. I wanted to highlight that what I was suggesting was kind of a halfway house between the two views of let's not put something in the standard because it's repeating a general requirement, and for to really prompt the behaviors we're looking, we need to put something in the standard. But what I'm suggesting is that if I look at question two, that in B, we do not add an explicit requirement for an entity to disclose the basis. So we don't write, thou shalt do X. But what we do write is something in the authoritative standard that says the basis of preparation of the, put in the proper word for pro formas, should be treated as an accounting policy and therefore subject to the general requirements for disclosure of significant accounting policy information. It's picking up on what Neely was just talking about whether everybody would regard it that way. And because of that, I think it would automatically, it isn't just an explicit requirement, it's connecting dots.
I think that was really where we're trying to go. Sue?
I think that's a good idea. My memory serves me well. Did we end up doing that for inventory?
We did something, we have something similar in IFRS 13 for fair value measurement, where we say changes shall be treated as changes in accounting estimates. So we could use a similar approach. My just slight pause on that here is, if we say it shall be treated as an accounting policy, it might imply that it's not an accounting policy by default, and therefore the board had to specify something.
Just say it is an accounting policy. Just say it is an accounting
policy. It isn't. Yeah.
Okay. So are we ready to vote?
So shall we ask the board each question in turn?
I would not do a bulk vote. I would do that one by one. I mean, considering all the different comments that have been made. So if we start with the first one on question two, can I suggest that we amended, as you just said, and as Mary has proposed, to say we agree, clarify the objective, and not to provide extensive application guidance, but to actually have, as you say, connecting the dots, making it clear that we want you to actually treat the basis for this as an accounting policy as per IAS 1.
So we're saying that we'll actually put that in the standard?
Yes.
This is an accounting policy?
Yes.
I think that we have many discussions about whether I'm dealing with an accounting estimate or an accounting policy. We have this in many parts of the standards. If every time that we have a question whether this is an accounting estimate or an accounting policy, we want to flag whether, no, this is an accounting policy. I think that we are what we call temptation to include something that, in my view, it is in this standard. I understood the proposal. I mean, that in the end of the day, the B would say we would not add an explicit requirement. Actually, we are going to work with the wording to include that this is an accounting policy. That's what is proposed.
Yes.
Note in the body of the standard that
yeah.
this is
the body of the standard. Yeah, yeah, I understood that. Yeah. Thank you,
Tom.
Can I just ask a question? As I'm getting confused, just based picking up what Neely said and Tadeo just said and what's proposed. So when people think about what's an estimate versus what's a policy, and they're confused, you can go and look at precedent. You can look at other standards. And is everybody okay if they go and look at this and say, aha, I now can tell a policy from an estimate and apply it to those cases that Tadeo has raised?
I think the issue, at least to my mind, is not so much policy versus estimate. It's simply disclosing the basis of preparation. Yeah. Do we explicitly say disclose the basis of preparation in the standard? Or do we say it's already required in IS-1 and therefore we don't have to repeat it?
I understand. I'm just saying if we go this route, is everybody happy that it's a nice precedent? Because you can do that, right?
I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
I don't think it's
just, I just wanted to ask the question.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. So with that amendment or suggested amendment, can I see a show of hands who agrees with probably take it in turn, question two and question three. So it's actually after paragraph 37, it has a little A, little B. I treat this as question two and question three, right? So
what we've just discussed is actually question three then, rather than question two. So can I see a show of hands who agrees with two, clarify the objective, perform information, not provide detailed application guidance?
Without using those words.
Yeah. Yes, right.
Okay. 11 when absent.
Okay. And not to add an explicit requirement for an entity to disclose the basis to prepare pro forma information, but actually specify that...
It's an accounting policy,
and not put that into the basis, but really have that
in
the main part of the standard. Could I see a show of hands who would agree with that?
9-1 absent.
Okay. So the next question then, question four. Can I see who agrees with... replacing profit or loss with operating profit or loss. That's notwithstanding the comments that both Nick and Zach had made, obviously, because there may be some bits that that are occurring below the line, as you pointed it. But can I see a show of hands who would agree with replacing profit or loss with operating profit or loss?
11 when absent.
Okay. And question five. Does the board agree with the staff recommendation not to proceed with a preliminary review to add a requirement to disclose pro forma information about cash flows arising from operating activities? Can I see a show of hands?
Could I ask a quick question before
you
proceed? Sorry, I didn't handle this in my earlier comments. Question for the staff on this one, because we proposed two things, and we got feedback that one of the two was too hard. Was the pro forma information or the combined information after the acquisition. Why the decision to strike both the information before the acquisition and after? Because the only commentary I really saw against the information from before the acquisition came from financial companies, who, as a former financial analyst, I understand why they don't want to provide it and don't think it's relevant. But that's not a full universe of companies.
And I guess it's not something we considered particularly.
Yeah, no, but just in general, the feedback suggested that this information was not useful and it would be too costly. And it was in the context of just the cash flow information that the pro forma or non-pro forma would just be not be useful, and it would just be costly to separate out in either situation.
Okay. So that can be vote with that clarification. Can I see a show of hands?
10-1 absent.
Okay. So we have used part of our break, but my recommendation would be to actually now take a break and reconvene at the same time, which is 5 past, I think. 5 past the hour, so break for 20 minutes. Thank you.